Open with a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Father, I just want to thank you, first of all, for just this beautiful place that we can come and not only learn more about you, but learn what it is you have for us and things and the challenges that we get. I thank you for the speakers that are here this weekend that have taken their time to share what you've shared with them. And I just pray that today you would give me the wisdom and the insight to be able to say the things that you want me to say that would be challenging and encouraging and that it would answer the questions that these men have. Thank you for bringing them out. I pray you'd bless them. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Real quick, as I mentioned this morning, I am a tax trust and estate attorney. Had been a pastor in a former life, and was one of those weird ones that actually went back to law school after being a pastor. And the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing is because I just had a burden to be able to share with people in an environment like this, where this is a ministry to you. There's a lot of places you can go to hear seminars and hear people talk about some of these topics. But the two things that I think are unique about this is there are no strings attached. I'm not going to be asking you for anything. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm not trying to market you anything. I'm just here to answer your questions. And almost every seminar you go to, someone's trying to market their services or a product. The second thing, and again, there's nothing wrong with that, but this is I'm trying to make this very objective for you. The other thing is that this is really going to be from a perspective where we're going to talk about what is it that God would have us do, and there aren't a lot of places where you can hear this topic talked about in the manner that you want to have a biblical approach to it. So that was my burden, and that's why I'm here. Actually, why I work for Hume is because I wanted to be able to be in a place where I could do that. I have been in private practice. I still have a small private practice that I maintain, but this is my full-time job. And part of what I do is not only teach these seminars, but as an extension of the seminars, and we'll talk more about it at the end, I offer opportunities to be for you to consult with me individually, with you, if you have your spouse, with your spouse, and just sit across the kitchen table and ask questions or have me review documents. And again, that's a ministry that's offered to anybody who comes to any of our seminars with Hume. And I do that. My job is I travel. So this next week, I'm going to be spending 3 days on the Central Coast, and I'll be seeing 10 families that have signed up in previous seminars that said, we'd like to talk to you individually about this. And then the week after that, I'm in the Bay Area in Sacramento. So I kind of move around and do that kind of thing. But as we're talking about this subject, and we want to look at it from a perspective, a biblical perspective, I'm going to try to move kind of quickly, and I'm going to ask if you could jot down any questions or try to hold the questions as much as possible to the end. I'm also going to be available here. I'll stay around as long as you have questions and answer your questions as much as I can individually. But if you have a question and it's something that pertains just to you and your particular circumstance, come up afterwards so we don't take the whole group's time to just answer a very specific question. So, all right, there are three primary goals when we're looking at planning our estates, which are our estates are the things that God's allowed us to accumulate during our lifetime. And as we approach this, we have to understand that there are two really unique things that are taking place in our culture that have never happened before. One of those is that the personal wealth of the average person has increased significantly in the last generation and a half. Since World War II, people just are acquiring more things, and we're acquiring more property and things like that. So the average person is wealthier. The second issue is the form of that wealth is completely shifting from what it used to be. When I talk to my dad, and he's 94, and when I talk to him about what he inherited, he was saying, well, it was always something that we kept in the family. It was a family home, it was a family ranch or farm or business, but it wasn't something like it is today, where if you look at most of the things you own, there's a really good chance that everything within about 3 to 6 months will be liquidated, and what your family, your kids, if you have kids, what the beneficiaries are going to get are checks. That's what's happening today. And what's making that so unique is we haven't prepared this generation for that, and they're getting checks, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, that they did nothing to get. They have no investment or sweat in this. And so what I call it is, I'm looking at what I call a generation of lottery winners, because it's exactly the same situation. They're getting these checks that they had no investment in. And statistically, we now have a generation where we can look back and we've been able to see that the statistics that occur with lottery winners are happening with beneficiaries of estates, because it's the same kind of thing. And it creates this I call it a euphoria, where all of a sudden you've got this big bank account you never had before, more money than you ever thought you'd have in many cases, and you're kind of thinking, oh, I have an unlimited resource. And what we're seeing statistically is about 90% of beneficiaries within 3 to 5 years have little to nothing left. And that's almost identical to lottery winners. It's really sad. So we as men, especially as Christian men, I believe have the obligation to try to help and guide our kids, if we're leaving it to kids or whoever our beneficiaries are, to try to help them, to give them a head start and recognize this is an opportunity of a lifetime, probably the biggest chance they're ever going to have to do something significant with something. So three primary goals. One, we want to reduce or eliminate estate taxes. This is one of many kinds of taxes. We'll talk about different taxes. Secondly, we want to try to eliminate or get out of any kind of a probate. We're going to talk about all of these in depth, so you'll know what they are. And third is we want to be able to control who's getting what we have and how they're getting it and when they're getting it. We want to be in control of those things so that we know who's getting the stuff. So let's talk about each one of these. The first one's taxes. Fortunately, the taxes... Now, we're looking at a really weird time, because as of yesterday, there was a new tax bill proposal that was passed, which means that they're now going to be able to debate it and talk about it and refine it. Doesn't mean anything's changed, but it means that the change is coming. Currently, we have an exemption, which means you can accumulate per person up to $5.49 million before there's a dime of estate tax. If you're a married couple, there's ways to combine that, so you actually could pass on almost $11 million before there's tax. But the tax, once it goes above that, is the worst possible tax, and they do that because you're not around to fight it. It starts at 39.6%, 40%, and goes up to as high as almost 50%. So it's a tax that we don't want to have, but fortunately, most people, I doubt there's too many people in this room that have over $5.5 million in personal assets. If you do, there still are ways to avoid that tax. But right now, most people don't have that. Second priority was probate. Probate is not a tax. We think of it as a tax because we think about having to pay for probate. Probate is a process. It's a process of having someone's estate go through the court system. And then at the other end, the court stamps it and says, yes, everything's okay, you can now distribute the assets. Each individual state has their own laws. So California has its laws. If you live in another state, they might be slightly different. But each state dictates what's going to happen. And the interesting thing is, probate is triggered by two things, because we don't want probate. We don't want probate because it's expensive. It runs between 4 and 8% of the gross value of everything you own. The second reason we don't want it is it's time consuming. Everything gets locked up in that court system for between, at minimum, 6 to 12 months. It's supposed to get out in 12 months, but I rarely have had a probate I've worked on that's gotten out of the court within 12 months, which means those assets are virtually frozen. And then third, everything that goes through the court system is public record and everybody gets to know about it. So we really don't want probate. So we have to get rid of it. And to get rid of it, we have to know what causes it. And what causes it is two things. One, we have to own something. So we have to own something in our name. And that could be a bank account that's held in our name. It could be, we could even own something as joint tenants, which means that it's with someone else, usually a spouse. And all that is really a probate delaying technique. What that means is you're going to die, your spouse is going to die. After the last of the two of you die, then it's going to go through a probate because there's no probate between spouses, there's no probate between joint tenants, but ultimately everyone's going to die. And so after the last person dies, it's owned in their name, and that fulfills the first requirement, ownership. The second requirement is that it must exceed a certain minimal value. And the value is determined by what type of property it is. There's two kinds of property: real property, which is real estate, and personal property, which is everything else. It could be bank accounts, could be your furnishing, clothing, all the things, the cars, all those things. If it's real estate in California, it can't exceed $50,000 without triggering a probate. Well, how many of you own property in California worth less than $50,000? I don't think there is anything. So that means that if you own real property and it's in your name or you and your spouse's name, and we're not talking about living trust now, that's a different way of holding title, but it's in your name, then it will go through probate if it's over $50,000. The other type of property, personal property, it can be $150,000. So it could be bank accounts, other types of investments. Not talking about retirement accounts. Retirement accounts are separate, but everything else. Or it could be a combination of your $40,000 piece of real estate and then $120,000 worth of assets. The combination over 150 triggers it. So how do we get rid of probate? If we have to have these two things, ownership and value, we change ownership and we play little tricks with the ownership. And by the way, this goes back to law that dates back to the 1200s. So it's nothing new. The techniques have been well established. And the most common is what we call a living trust. And I'm going to use this box as an example. What a living trust does is it acts like a box. It's an entity like a corporation that exists on paper. There's nothing in this box when you create it, when you create your trust. But then you transfer the title of the things that you own into your box. So for instance, if I were going to transfer my car or my house or whatever I'm going to represent my keys, I would transfer them into the ownership of this. The way I do that, my house, for instance, is titled David and Judy Harrison as trustees of the Harrison Family Trust. So this is the Harrison Family Trust. The trustees are the only people who have any use, management, or enjoyment of anything inside here. And by the way, as the creator of the trust, I have preserved the right to take things out, to put things in anytime I want to. There's no difference than owning it outright. I could go ahead and refinance. I can do anything I want to. But I put it inside here and I say that the trust technically owns it. I don't own it. So at my death, if everything has been transferred into the trust, what do I own in my name? It's not a trick question. Nothing. It's all owned by my trust. So the death doesn't trigger a probate because there's nothing owned in my name. It's owned by my trust. And then after my death, my wife continues to function just like she did before. She can take things out. She can use things. She can do anything she wants to with anything in her trust. But when she dies, everything then passes to who we've named as our beneficiaries, just like in a will. So we can say we're going to leave it to all of our kids, we're going to leave it to our church, we're going to leave it to anybody we want to, and it can function just like that. So what we've done is change the ownership so we no longer own anything, and that's eliminated the probate. Does that make sense? It's not a real... Lawyers try to make it really complicated because then we can charge you more. It's not that complicated. It's just a method of changing ownership. So the next slide kind of talks about that. We've got to get rid of one or the other, ownership or value. And we don't want to get rid of value because if we get rid of the value, that means we don't get to use it. So that means we have to give things away. So we're not going to do that. So we've gotten rid of that. So now we've talked about two of the three. No estate tax because it's up to $5.5 million. No probate because we've changed the ownership. And now how do we control the distributions?
Wait, sure. Why is probate so bad? Like if the house goes into probate, so
mm-hmm.
what?
Okay. Why is probate so bad? Probate's bad because, one, the asset is locked up. It can't transfer ownership. So if you die and you wanted that house to go to your kids, it's going to go through the court system for the next year, and nothing can happen to that. Here's another example. The courts are so impacted, so behind, that I filed a probate in LA County about, oh, maybe 2 months ago, and I asked for the next available court date. And the first date in a probate is where they approve the person who's going to be in charge. And until that person is approved by the court and they have a document to prove that they are now in charge, nothing can be done. No bank accounts can be touched. They can't open bank accounts. And in this case, they had a piece of property that was earning rental income. They couldn't deposit checks. And the nearest court date was 3 months away. So we had to wait 3 months with these checks coming in, and the beneficiary, the granddaughter, had no way to pay bills. She had to pay them out of her pocket because she wasn't appointed officially to represent the estate. So once they were appointed, then it's going to take about another year to go through the process of having the court say, okay, title's clear, everything's okay. And during that year, she's going to end up paying between 4% and 8% of the gross value of all the assets. So let's say the house in LA County was worth $600,000. She's going to pay 4% to 8% of that just to go through the court system to be able to have it come out the end and say, okay, now you can sell the house, or now you can put it in your name. Now it's yours to deal with any way you want to. So the reason we don't like it is because it ties up the asset and then it costs us a lot of money. And it's avoidable. It's completely avoidable. Okay, so control distributions, that's the next one. Yes, sir.
4% to 8% is a court fee. Pardon
me?
4% to 8%
Well, it's a combination. It's a combination of court fees, and there's a lot of different fees that are thrown in there. You've got to publish everything in a newspaper so that everybody has a fair legal notice that it's going on. So debtors or creditors can come out of the woodwork. But probably a majority of those fees, to be honest, are going to be the attorney's fees, because the attorney will invest between 40 and 100 hours of work having to get this thing through the system, because the system's so backlogged. So a lot of it's attorney's fees. Probably 20% of it are fees that are related to just expenses that are going to come up. So again, you're making the attorney wealthy by doing that. So distributions, what are we talking about here? This is where we're saying, how do we make sure that we get it to who we want, when we want, and how we want it? And for me, what I found too in my experience, I've been doing this about 23 years, and what I found is that that kids are different than they were even 20 years ago. And they're maturing a lot slower than they did 20 years ago financially. And part of the reason for that is I take responsibility, because I've got kids now in their 30s, is we're rescuing our kids later and later in life, helping them out when they get into trouble, and we're not allowing them to experience consequences for making bad mistakes. And that's the way we learn. We learn by making mistakes, having to dust ourselves off, stand back up, and then we're not going to do that again. But if every time we have a mistake, our kids call the bank of mom and dad bail them out, they never learn learn from their mistakes. So what we're seeing is that kids are getting into their 30s and sometimes even 40s, and they're not financially independent yet. They haven't learned the lessons they need to learn. So what do we do about that? How do we help them learn these lessons? I'll just describe what I've done with my kids. I've got a quiver full of kids. I've got 6 boys and 1 girl. And boys, by the way, we tend to be even worse at it than girls do for some reason. I don't know why. But what I've done with my kids is I've noticed, of course, that they're maturing later in life. So what I've said with my kids is, first of all, I've set an age restriction. If they're below that age when we die, then I'll have my successor, the person who's going to step into my shoes, my executor, they're going to take care of my kids just like I would. If they have a health need, an education need, a wedding that we would help them for, anything that we would have done, my successor is able to do. They're empowered to do. But I'm not going to let my child make the decisions about their inheritance themselves. For me, it's until they're 35. And the reason why is because I want my kids to live enough of life and have enough of life's lessons that they have some wisdom under their belt before they get this check. So what I've said is, my kids, you'll be taken care of just like I were there until you're 35. But at 35, then you guys, I'm going to turn the keys over to you. And now it's your turn to start to learn how to manage this. Hopefully they'll be financially independent by that time. And then I've done another thing. I found that there's a lot of really good helps out there, things that can help assist people learn about how to deal with money. So what I've required for my kids, it's going to take my family about 3 to 6 months from the date of my wife and my death, the last of us to die, before they can settle my estate. 3 to 6 months is about what it takes. You got to make sure all bills are paid and everything's come in and you've taken care of all that. You might need to sell some things, but it's going to take that long. So during those 3 to 6 months, what I've told my kids is you've got to go through one of two different financial training programs. One of them is called Financial Peace University by Dave Ramsey. It's offered through churches, through public organizations, on the internet. It's offered on CD. It's about 15 hours worth of material, very entertaining, very easy for them to sit through, but it teaches them all about budgeting and investing and interest and all the good things that we don't really talk a lot about. So I've told my kids, you've got 3 months to take these 15 hours worth of requirements, and you're going to report back to the trustee and say, yep, I've done it. Here's my certificate of completion. And that's the gateway that, unless they do that, I'm not going to let my trustee distribute to them. Now, the other program that's out there is called, it's through Crown Ministries, called Money Life, and it's a Christian-based program. Financial Peace University is a crossover program. It's written by a Christian, but it's not specifically a Christian program. Either one of them, they can take either one of those two programs. Both of them are about the same length of time. I actually have taken three of my seven kids through those programs, four of my seven kids through those programs right now. I've bought the CDs and we sit down as a family and we've watched the programs together. So it's something easy for them to do, but it will give them a little bit of a heads up about basic financial money management. So that's one requirement. The other requirement is, I found that there's a whole lot of wisdom, surprise, surprise, to the scriptures where they tell you that it's good to have someone who's a wise counselor that you can talk things through with. So what I've said for my kids is, before my successor trustee distributes to you, you've got to appoint someone that's going to be your counselor, someone that you're going to bounce ideas off of. Here's why. The reason why almost 90% of the beneficiaries blow the money is because of impulsive spending, because they make decisions before they think about them. So what I'm trying to do is, I'm trying to create a speed bump for my kids, slow them down enough that they can stop and say, wait a second, maybe it's not a good idea to buy all my friends jet skis. Maybe I should think that through a little more. And if they talk with someone who's independent from them, who's not their spouse or sibling, then they can get some wisdom. Now, I don't know who they're going to pick, and it's possible they may try to pick someone who they can manipulate. So I'm going to tell them, you can pick anybody you want. I don't know who's going to be alive. I'm not going to pick them for you. I want you to pick them that you can work with them. They don't have to be a professional, but I want two requirements for that person. I want them to be a Bible-believing Christian, because I want that person to have the same worldview that I have. I want them to have the influence that I would have given them. Secondly, I want them to be someone who at least has some basic financial understanding. It could even have been someone who's gone through those two money training programs, Financial Peace or Money Life. But just not the person off the street that they're going to be easily able to manipulate. Now, those are my requirements. I have a couple of my kids who aren't walking with the Lord real closely right now, and they've pushed back on the Bible-believing Christian part. They've said, why do we need to pick someone who's a Christian? And they said, you know that, you know, at this point in our lives, that's not necessarily what we're buying into. And I said, okay, well, I'm not going to force you to pick a Christian. And I'm not going to force you to take my money. It's real simple, though. This is stuff that God's entrusted to me, and I get to make the rules. And that's one of the rules. And if you don't like the rule, that's okay. I'm not going to force you to take it. And of course, they say, oh, no, that's okay. We can figure out a way to work with someone. My oldest son is the one I'm probably the most worried about, because he's probably he's the one who would buy all of his friends jet skis. And so what I did was I've explained what I've done to all of my kids. And I've said, this is why I've done it. You know, I've done it because I believe I have a responsibility to the Lord to be responsible with the things he's entrusted to me. And here's how I've done that for you. And my oldest son said, well, wait a second, Dad. If you've told me that you want me to pick the person that I can work with, and you've told me that I can hire and fire that person, which I did, I don't want them to have someone who says no to everything, because I'm not trying to keep them from their inheritance. Again, I'm trying to create a speed bump. I'm trying to slow them down, make them think about what they're doing. So I said, yeah, you can hire anybody. And so he said, so what's to keep me from hiring and firing until I find someone who meets your requirements but will also say yes to everything I ask them? And I said, nothing. I said, if you want to circumvent that, what I've done for you, you can do it. I'm only going to do so much. I'm not trying to keep you from it. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to guide you. So if you don't choose to use it, that's your choice. But here's what you're compromising. One, you're compromising the ability to be able to have someone else who you can talk to and help you make good decisions. The second thing you're compromising, which I didn't tell you before, is if you follow those rules, it falls within a category where all of a sudden you have limited asset protection, which means that as long as you follow the rules and you keep it intact and you use the counselor as what we call a co-decision maker, I said, then everything that's going to be in that pot there will not be subject to divorces, bankruptcies, lawsuits, judgments, and liens. That's really worth a lot to them. And the biggest thing I'm worried about for my kids, to be real frank, is the potential divorce, where they could end up losing half of their inheritance to someone who may be leaving them. So I said, if you don't follow the rules, then it's just like someone left it to you and someone else can take it away from you. So what I've tried to do is protect them from themselves, from making bad decisions, and then protect them from others who are going to try to take that away from them. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Do these stipulations go away after they turn 35?
Nope. The question was, do the stipulations go away after they turn 35? No, and I'm sorry if it was confusing. The 35 is the age in which the keys get turned over to them, and they then get to pick their counselor. Up until then, they don't even have decisions. They just go to my trustee, just like if I were still alive, and they said, I need some money for a wedding. I'd like some money for a down payment, whatever it might be. Now, someone has said to me, well, why don't you get away with all those restrictions and stipulations at, let's say, 50. They no longer need it. Well, that's great, except Why should I pick the date when my kids lose the asset protection? If they have the choice to hire and fire until they find someone that they can bleed the thing dry in a day from, they have all the control. I'd rather leave the control with them and let them decide, you know what, I no longer need these restrictions. I'm 55, I'm 60. In reality, if we live our life expectancy, do you know how old our kids are going to be when they inherit? They're going to be in their 60s, most likely, maybe even older than that. So hopefully they've learned some lessons. But what I'm trying to do is set up a structure that protects them from others too. And I'm not going to pick an arbitrary date where they lose that protection. I'm going to let them have the control to do that. Yes, sir.
Is that in the revocable trust or the irrevocable trust?
That would be a revocable trust. Yeah. Now, what it's created is it's creating what I call sub-trust or children's trust for the children. And that's how they get those protections. Okay, let's move on because we've got some other stuff we want to talk about. Okay, protecting them from themselves, protecting them from others. Okay, here's another big obstacle. Most of us are creating wealth within vehicles today that have built-in taxation. How many of you are contributing to a retirement plan or a 401k or IRA 403b? Yeah, a lot of us. And that's where many of us are accumulating a majority of our liquid assets. Our wealth is coming in that form. But what you've done when you do that, which by the way, I fully support, but what you've done is you've made a deal with the IRS and the deal was pay me the tax now or pay me the tax later. And what did you choose?
Later.
Pay the tax later. Right. So what that means is when you get to be the age where you have to start taking withdrawals, which is about 70 and a half, then you start paying taxes every time you take a withdrawal on the money you've never paid taxes on. But until that point, even the money that you didn't pay to the tax, the money that really is the government's money, that's earning interest. And that's a good deal. So here's the problem. The problem is that tax never goes away. So when we die and we leave that, we pass on retirement accounts, by the way, just like life insurance. We have beneficiaries that we name, and we name usually our spouse first if we're married, and if we don't have a spouse, then we name our kids or whoever else you want to name. But the kids are standing in line after our spouse to inherit. And one of the problems that we run into is there's different rules for spouses and there's different rules for kids. Now, these are just some of the types of taxes that we end up paying. You know, we had a revolution because there was double taxation. Well, a lot of these taxations here are built one on top of the other, on top of the other. We earn it and we pay income tax. We spend it, we pay sales tax. We appreciate assets that we've invested in after tax, and that's capital gains tax. We die and we pay estate tax. I mean, this is much worse than what we ever had with England, but those are the kinds of taxes that we're dealing with. So the largest cash assets are typically retirement accounts, and here's the two options. If you have a spouse and they inherit your IRA, so my wife, Judy, inherits my IRAs or 401s. I'm using the term IRA and I mean 401s, 403bs, 457s, which by the way, if you're ever wondering where those names came from, that's the Internal Revenue Code section that covers those particular plans. So you know where it comes from. So I leave my IRA to my wife and my wife has two choices. If she needs the income right away, even if she's not 59 and a half, which is the minimum age she can start taking without penalty, she can opt, because she's my spouse, to start taking the income right away with no penalty. So that's the benefit of a spouse. Or she can roll it over and make it her own plan and defer taking out anything until she turns 70 and a half. So it becomes her plan. It's a rollover. But only the spouse has that privilege. When it goes down to the kids don't get to do a rollover and they don't get to make a decision. What happens for the kids is they're faced with a choice, normally one of two choices, depends on how old you are when you start, when you die. But the choices are they can either take a lump sum withdrawal in the year in which you die, or they can defer their withdrawals and start to take them out as annual installments for the rest of their life expectancy. Which choice do you think most kids are going to pick? The immediate lump sum withdrawal. But guess what happens when they do that? All the deferred tax becomes due at once. It shoots their tax bracket up because the entire value is considered to be income, and they could lose 40 to 45% of it in immediate tax. But many of them, even if they know that, say, well, you know what? That's okay. It's worth $400,000. I'm still going to get $300,000. I'll take it. Now here's, oh yes. This isn't even talking about the 5.5. This is a different tax. This is income tax. So this is based upon $1. It starts at $1 and it's income tax. So what happens for your kids is as they start taking withdrawals, whether it's a lump sum or annual, it's just like it's added income to whatever they make. and they get taxed at whatever their normal income tax rate is. So here's an example. 52-year-old is going to be inheriting his father's $300,000 IRA. He has two choices. He can take a lump sum withdrawal, or he can take it out over his life expectancy. If he takes the lump sum withdrawal after he pays the taxes for that year, because again, his income is now bumped up by $300,000, so he shoots into the highest tax bracket, he will only get about $167,000 after tax out of $300,000. If he chooses to defer it and take it out over his life expectancy, all that tax that he hasn't paid, that he paid up front, that he's now not paying, gets to compound and earn interest the rest of his life expectancy. That $300,000 then grows and pays out to him over the next 40 years or so, almost $700,000. Do you see the difference? I mean, it's astronomical. And unfortunately, most of our kids are going to make the stupid decision because either they don't know, and they're going to find out, though, the next April 15th when their taxes are due. Or they choose because it's so much that they're feeling like, okay, I get this check tomorrow if I say yes, I want it all, whereas otherwise I'm going to have to take annual installments. Well, you know what I've decided for my kids? There's a way to do it where I can say to my kids, you're going to get all the other stuff that I'm going to leave you in the living trust, but the IRA, what I'm going to choose to do is I'm going to make the decision for you. And I'm choosing for your benefit to take the annual installment. So you're going to get a check every year for the rest of your life. You're going to get all this other stuff, and you can do what you want to with that. But the IRA, I've made the decision for you. Now, what that does is it does a couple of other things too. If your child predeceases you or dies soon after, around the time you do, then their children stand in line to inherit the IRA, okay? Your grandchildren. And if you don't do anything but just say, I'm leaving it to the kids or to their, what the term is, as we call it, their issue, their children, if that's all you say on the beneficiary designation, guess how old they can be and take a decision to make a withdrawal? The legal age of 18. How many 18-year-olds do you know that are going to make a good decision? Probably not very many of them. So what we're able to do when we structure this, what we actually are doing is we're creating a brand new kind of a box, that this box is going to be called a retirement trust. It's not the living trust. And what the retirement trust does is it sits empty during your entire lifetime, and it says, after both my spouse and I are dead, it becomes the beneficiary of my retirement plan, and then it will spill out to my kids, and I can determine the terms of how it's going to do it. There's really no other way to do that is other than to use this. This is a kind of a new vehicle created in about 2006. Yes, sir.
So my mom passed at 70 and a half. Me and my sisters inherited her IRA, and our withdrawals have been set up to go into an IRA for the three of us. So we don't even take that money. It just goes into our own retirement account.
Okay, his comment was his mom died. And you and your sister?
Me and two sisters.
You and two sisters received the IRA, and that the IRA funds, the proceeds that are coming out, automatically are going into your own IRA.
He set up an account for all three of us, so they're moving right into that.
So
he called it an inherited IRA.
Okay, an inherited IRA is the term for any IRA that passes to a non-spouse generation. So an inherited IRA is just the IRS term. I would be real interested in seeing that, because that violates, that money can't be rolled over to anybody but a spouse. So I'm not sure how they did that. That would be real interesting.
You said that earlier, I was a little concerned.
Yeah.
Because you said it could be done.
Yeah, it can't. And the only exception would be if the proceeds are small enough that they are your IRA contribution for the year, and he's just using those to reinvest as an IRA.
Contribute to a 401k.
Uh-huh.
That was under the assumption when you do that, you can't have a personal IRA.
That's correct.
But he knows all those
Yep. Well, I would be real interested. I'd like to have the name so I can talk to him and find out what he's done, because I'm a tax lawyer, and I can tell you that that doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard of. His second comment was that he was under the impression, which is correct, that if you're contributing to a 401k at work, you're not able to have your own individual IRA, personal IRA, that you contribute to every year too, and that's usually correct. There's rare exceptions to that. You can do a Roth. You can do an after-tax, but you can't put pre-tax. Okay, let's move on. And so this is the technique that we're talking about is what's called a retirement plan trust. Prevents younger beneficiaries from getting it. You can put an age restriction again. It forces that, what we call the stretch out, which is the payout over their life expectancy. And it also provides asset protection. So again, the same kind of protection we talked about for our kids can give them divorce proof, bankruptcy proof, lawsuit proof, all those kinds of things, which normally they won't have if they just inherit the IRA and you've named them directly as a beneficiaries. So that's an option. These are kind of rare. They're becoming more popular, but it takes a fairly sophisticated attorney to draft these because they haven't been around a lot and they're very, very specific language that's already gone through the tax court. Okay, talking about how things reflect our faith. This is, to me, probably the most important thing because most of us, I heard the tail end of the message today and he was talking a little bit about the things that we've acquired. If you're a believer, what you have to start with the premise is that God owns everything. We're merely managing things during our lifetime. He owns it. In fact, there's so many verses. I've got a bunch of them that I've put up here. But first of all, the problem is that money and possessions have fooled us into believing that we really own things and we really have the control. But contrary to that, these are the scripture verses that talk about that's not true. For instance, 1 Chronicles 29:11 says, it says, "Yours, O Lord, are the riches and the honor and the glory and the victory and the majesty, for everything in the heavens and in the earth is yours." There's another verse up here, Deuteronomy 8, that talks about the guy who can smugly say, "Well, wait a second, I've built all these things myself. It's my hard work. I'm a self-made man." And it's kind of interesting. This verse says, "Beware lest you say in your heart, 'It is my work, and through the might of my hand, I have acquired this wealth.' You must honor the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to make wealth." And so as we look at this, we have to start with the premise that God owns everything. Now, it's interesting. Jesus talked more about money than he did anything else. A majority of the parables deal in some way with the concept of stewardship or money or possessions. He talked about this. There are a couple of parables where he's talking about the master and the steward, and the concept was a steward is what we call today a manager. It was someone who would manage the resources of the master, the person who owned them, but he'd be managing those resources for the benefit of the master. Remember what the story was about the parable where the stewards invested the money and different ones invested it different ways? The money was always going back to the master. It was the master's money. And Jesus calls us stewards of God's kingdom, of the things that we've acquired during our lifetime. So if you look at that the way that it's talking about in Scripture, then that means that we're supposed to be managing these resources that we've been entrusted with during our lifetime for the benefit of the master. But how many of us do that? I mean, what do we do with our resources? We use them to make ourselves more comfortable. And that's only going to be temporary. And I think that's something that we really have to stop and evaluate, because our culture has fooled us into believing that that's acceptable, that we can do that. And I have a good friend who's a believer, and he actually rationalized buying a very expensive car by saying, "Well, you know, it just makes me more comfortable so that by the time I'm at work, I'm able to concentrate more effectively." And, you know, I didn't say anything, which now I look back and say, boy, I should have said something to him, because, you know, is that what God wanted us to do with those resources? So what's the obligation we may have regarding our estates? What do we do with these resources if God owns them? Here's some more verses that deal specifically with what may happen to these resources as they taint us and cause us to make decisions that aren't good. What happens? What do we get to do with these? Well, this is a great quote. I don't know if you know who John Stott is. John Stott's an English philosopher and theologian. He died about 5 years ago, I think, maybe longer. And he had just a great perspective about Christians and wealth. And one of the things he said is what Jesus forbids his followers is the selfish accumulation of goods, extravagant and luxurious living, the hard-heartedness which does not feel the colossal need of the world's underprivileged people, the foolish fantasy that a person's life consists in the abundance of his possessions, and the materialism which tethers our hearts to the earth. Do you agree? I mean, that really, I think, is a great summary of what God's not saying. I'm not going to bless you. He's the one who's the source of wealth. But it's how we treat the wealth that I think makes a difference in what we do. Okay. So God owns everything. We are his stewards. So here's three different options for what we can do with our wealth. Part of what I do is many times I'll sit down with families and I'll say, okay, so what is it you want to do with the assets that you have left over after you die? That's what your estate is. What do you want to do with it? And most of the time, one of the two will say to me, well, I guess we just equally divide it amongst our kids. That's a common philosophy. We'll just equally divide it amongst our kids. And what I used to say was, well, I'd like you to go home and pray about it and ask God if there's some of that that you've been blessed with that you should be giving back to God, even out of your estate. And I'll have couples do that. But I said this once to a good friend of mine who's a pastor. And he says, what is it you do? And I told him that's exactly what I just told you. And he said, I would never say that. And I said, what? And he chastised me. He says, that's absolutely wrong. And he said, if God owns everything, what business do we have coming to him and saying, God, what portion of all of your stuff do I have permission to carve off and give back to you? Do you get that? What portion of all of your stuff do I have permission to give back to you? Instead, he said, we should be coming to God saying, God, this is all your stuff. What portion of this do I have permission to carve off for my family? And I thought, wow, that is different. And I hadn't thought of it that way. Let's go back real quickly. What was a biblical inheritance? Because it says there that, you know, you're dishonored if you don't leave an inheritance to your grandchildren, is what the verse says. Well, an inheritance was a means to making a living. It was providing the next generation with a way to make a living. It was many times tied up in the family ranch or the family business, but it was providing them with a means, and usually it was housing. Back then at that time, people would actually live and they'd just expand the house and the next generation would move in. So it was providing with either a place to live or a means to make a living. James Dobson has a really good perspective. He says, you know what? I've done that with my kids. I not only helped them get through college and get an education where they can get jobs, but I've even helped them with down payments on their houses. And he says, and now I still have all of this left over, and it's not mine. It's God's. And it's not my kids, because I've already fulfilled the requirement of giving them what I need to give them. Now, so here's some three different options, and then I'll give you actually a fourth. One is we act as if we own everything and we just cut God out of the picture. We just say, okay, everything's going equally to my kids and that's the way it's going to be. The next is to seek to acknowledge God, and that's the idea where you come to him and say, what portion should I carve off for you? And then the third option is going to him saying, what portion should I carve off to my family? But here's another option. As my kids get older, my goal is for my kids to become more financially independent. Agreed? That's what we want. We want them to be independent. And as I've helped them become more independent, then what I believe is my obligation to provide for them diminishes. So I actually have drafted into my legal documents a scale that the older they get, the more of my estate goes to God's kingdom and the less goes to my kids. Now, I'm not cutting my kids out, but I'm trying to do it in a manner that's glorifying God and still helping my kids. I had one family I worked with several years ago that came to me, and they were referred by a large charity to my private practice, and we sat down, and the guy kind of slides across his balance sheet, and he says, "This is where what we have." And I'd never seen so many zeros in my life. You know, he had invented a product that we all use now, and his net worth was around $900 million. And he said, "But this isn't our money, it's God's money." And he said, "I made, on the best day of my life," he said, "I made about $60,000. But then I invented this product," and he says, "and now we have all this wealth, we have the company that manufactures it." And he says, "So what we do is our neighbors have no idea how much money we're worth." He said, "We live on $60,000 a year." He said, "My annual salary from my company is now about $300,000. And he says, "So my wife's job is to figure out how to give away $240,000 a year." And he says, "And she loves that job." And he says, "And what we've done with our kids is we've helped our kids get a start. They work in the business, that we've helped them with a house." And he says, "And we're leaving each of our kids $150,000. He says, "All the rest of it's going to God's kingdom." And I thought, wow, that is really honoring God with what he's entrusted you with, because it's really all his. Now, that's a hard thing for us to do. It's really hard for us to do. And many of us will never get to that place. But you know what? That, I think, is the model that we need to be looking at. Okay, last thing I want to talk about that's really important to you is what are called powers of attorney. And powers of attorney is a legal document where you're giving authority for someone else to step into your shoes and manage things for you if upon an incapacity. Could be temporary, it could be a long-term incapacity. There's two different powers of attorney today. They are specific to your state. Again, so California has its own unique ones. One is called the Healthcare Directive, Advanced Healthcare Directive. The other is called the Durable Power of Attorney, and it's over affairs and property. So let's talk about the Healthcare Directive first. Everybody, regardless of whether you have a will or a trust, should have these two documents, because if you get in a car accident and you're unconscious, these are the documents that allow your family or whoever you've left behind to be able to help make decisions. So healthcare first. It does three things. It tells who it is that you're selecting to be able to make decisions if you can't make them for your own healthcare. So you're unconscious, the surgery needs to be performed to save your life. Who do you entrust to say, "Yes, do this"? Second thing it does is it allows you to be able to pre-elect what kind of life-sustaining measures you want. If you're dying, there's no hope of recovery. Do you want them to keep your body alive for 10 years, or do you want them to let you die naturally and go to heaven? Most people say, "Let me die naturally. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die." Third thing it does is critical, and it's called the HIPAA releases. HIPAA is an acronym for an act that's called the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It was an act passed in 1996 that, buried in the midst of it, it had privacy provisions. And what these provisions state regarding medical, and you all have probably encountered this already, is that without your written permission naming the parties to whom you are authorizing the hospital to talk, your medical information cannot be released to anybody. Let me say that again. And it's naming the people that you have pre-authorized to be able to be talked to about your health condition. And if you don't have this, or you haven't named the people, they're not supposed to release anything. And they're now under a mandate. There's a $40,000 per violation fine for hospitals and medical institutions if they violate those provisions. So they're getting really strict about it. Here's how that works. I have a daughter, my only daughter. She's 30 years old. She was 19 and dating the guy that we now affectionately call the jerk. This guy, they were on a double date. He was driving and he was drinking. and he decided at about midnight one night to see how fast his parents' car would go with the kids, all the kids in the car. So he takes off in a straightaway down. We lived down in Orange County. He took off on this straightaway, and they calculated he was doing about 112 when he lost control, went through a street light, rolls a car a bunch of times, and all the kids ended up going to the hospital. So we get the call about midnight or 1 o'clock or so saying, your daughter's being rushed to the hospital. We show up at the hospital. We go up there. We say, we're Lindsay's parents. And of course, the first thing they want is our insurance information. So we pass on our insurance information. And then the clerk says, okay, so Lindsay was born on this date, so she's 19, correct? And as soon as they said that, I panicked, because I realized she's not my baby anymore. She's a legal adult. And I knew what the next thing was that they were saying. They were saying, do you have her health care directive so we can talk to you? And I said, no. I thought to myself, I do this for a living, and I didn't even realize my daughter needed one of these things. So they said, okay, well, take a seat. We'll talk to you when we can. Well, 4 hours passed, and we were just, what's going on with our daughter? Finally, they come back out, and it turns out she had fallen asleep. And as soon as she woke up, she asked for us, and we were ushered back. But until that time, she had not given permission, and she had not authorized it in writing, and so we couldn't get any information about her. And we just were assuming the worst. You know, what's going on? That's true even between spouses. The rule and the law does not make exceptions. It doesn't say, well, they can talk to anybody. They can talk to your spouse, but not anybody else. And I had it explained to me this way by an attorney for a hospital. He said, we're not placing our clerical staff in the position of having to determine, are you really married? Are you divorced? Are you estranged? Do you just happen to share the same last name? They said, that's not their job. If their name doesn't appear on this list that we have, we're not going to talk to them. So the next logical question's got to be, okay, so how do they get the list? You know, you're in a car accident, you're unconscious. Well, if you walked with me down to my car, I carry with me everywhere I go, in my glove box, in my luggage, wherever I'm going, copies of my healthcare directive naming my family and my wife, my dad's, who's 94, and my wife's. Because if I get a phone call that my dad has been rushed to the hospital, I drive right to the hospital, pull his envelope out of my glove compartment, walk up to the door, open up the envelope and say, here's my name, you can talk to me, what's going on? Now, some people say, what about digital copies? Can you use digital copies? So the answer is yes, of course you can. But if it's yours and you have it stored in Google Docs in your phone and you're unconscious, how are they gonna know how to get a hold of it? So there has to usually, I just have trusted the hard copies, and I know from talking with firemen and police that many times they'll go through a car in an accident looking for documents, and I have in big red magic marker on these envelopes, emergency medical papers take to hospital, and then my name on them. So that's the healthcare directive, incredibly important. The other one is covers everything else. This is the durable power of attorney for affairs and for finances. So this is the one that empowers someone to be able to step in, pay your bills, do whatever they need to, and most importantly, to step in and represent you before any institution or organization that needs to be talked to. You're unconscious, or you're sick, or you're laid up for a while and you can't talk, and the insurance company has questions. Have any of you ever tried to call an insurance company for someone else? They're not going to talk to you. Or you have a question, something comes up with your taxes. The IRS is not going to talk to anybody but you. Social Security, any of these institutions, organizations, the bank, or more importantly, the phone company. How do I get to the voicemails that have been left on my wife's phone? This document is the gatekeeper, and it says, these are the people I'm naming who have authority, who can step right into my shoes, and they can talk to you on my behalf. So that's another really important document. These are both freestanding documents. They don't necessarily have to be with a will or trust, but everybody should have those, because this opportunity of something happening to us is pretty great. Okay, I'm going to answer. Yep.
Do those documents have to be notarized?
One of them needs to, the finance or authority has to be notarized. healthcare directive can be notarized or it can be witnessed by two independent witnesses. Okay, a couple things, and then we're done. As I mentioned up front, I am available to you as a resource. There's no obligation, no cost. You don't have to write a check out to Hume Lake. This is a ministry to you just because you're here. And what that means is if you'd like to sit down with me and just ask me questions or to have me review your documents, one of the questions was, you know, my documents are 20 years old, or how often do I need to be looking at those? Well, the rule of thumb is you want to look at them about every 3 to 5, because laws change and people that you've named change, addresses change, phone numbers change, all that kind of stuff. Plus, if it's 20 years old, it's probably not got some of the provisions of the updated laws. If you had healthcare directives drafted before 2006, they don't include HIPAA. So you need to make sure you had new documents there. If you'd like for me to look at any of that, I would be happy to do that. I do it at your house, your place, wherever you're comfortable, your business, whatever it is. You just have to let me know where you are. So I've got a couple of sheets up here that if you're interested, I'll put one on each side. You can sign up. I do ask for your email because I really like to communicate by email. I organize all my appointments. So if I'm going to an area, I ask you just to let me know how to get in contact with you and say, okay, I'm coming to Sacramento, I'll come and see you. That's free of charge. Again, no obligation. Be happy to do that. It may just take me a month or two to kind of work to wherever you are, because I do 8 of these seminars in the fall and 8 in the winter, and I get a lot of appointments, so it takes me a while to do that. I also have some material up here. You're welcome to take my business card. There's a box of cards. You can contact me there. I have a brochure that I wrote that talks about the difference between wills and trusts and how do you know what you need. You can take one of those. I have some information up here about if you happen to want to help support Hume. This is the information about how to help and name Hume in your will or trust. And then over here, I have some books that I have personally picked that I think are good books to have in your library. This one here, called Provide and Protect, is a book about estate planning. It's written by a Christian author, but it's a crossover book. It's not necessarily written from a Christian perspective, but a great book. It goes into a lot of depth, answers a lot of questions, but it's very readable. I have that one up here, and I also have another smaller book that deals with our biblical responsibility with finances. It's written by Randy Alcorn, called The Treasure Principle. And these books I buy in boxes to bring and give to you. And so you're welcome to take these if you would like to help defer the cost, because I pay for this out of my pocket. Hume doesn't pay for this. I end up paying, after shipping, about $7 for this book and $10 for that. If you want it, you don't have money, and you just want to take it, then help yourself. These are my gift to you. I don't have enough for all of you, so if you are interested, you'll want to come up and get them. If you decide you want to help and defer the cost, just drop it in here. You don't need to see me. You can put it in there. Any final questions? Again, you can come up and ask individual questions. Yes? Yes. What are, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part. What are what? How do we know what financial independence is? Okay. Well, I think financial independence is really determined by being able to manage resources and be self-sufficient. So if you're, I can't tell you the number of 50-year-olds I'm still hearing about that are still getting into crisis and calling their 80-year-old parent for, you know, to bail them out. So it would be someone who can stand on their own 2 feet and has become independent both in their earning capacity and their ability to manage money. Question back there?
Yeah, so if we don't have cash, we want to buy both of those books, how else can we send something?
Well, if you can either write a check or take my card and do it that way. But if that's an issue, just take it. I really, you know, it's up to you. Yes?
When you spoke of the family trust, you only mentioned the husband and spouse or whatever named in it. Who else can, if anyone can be named in a family trust.
Okay, in a family trust, who can be named? Well, two people usually create it, or one person if you're single. And they are what are called the trustors, the creator of the trust. Another term that's been used is grantor, but those terms have been used for hundreds of years. They're the only ones who have the ability to modify or change or revoke the trust. Then you can name people who are trustees, who are the managers. Usually you name yourself, but as you get older, like my dad, he's now named me as a co-trustee with him because he just needs some help at 94. But you can have different trustees. And then the third level is what are called beneficiaries. And these are the people who are the ones who are going to be benefiting after both of you have died. Yes?
So on the beneficiaries, how do they receive the trust without incurring all the tax?
Okay. Well, how do beneficiaries receive the trust without incurring all the tax? The only tax that applies to that resource is going to be estate tax, which has the $5.49 million threshold. So most likely there won't be any estate tax. The only other assets that you have in your estate that have tax built into them are going to be either your retirement plans or annuities that are all tax deferred. So those, they can avoid the tax. Everything else, it's automatic. Unless it goes over 5.49, they're free and clear. Here, yep, go ahead.
I have a trust and I'm named an executor of the estate. Is there a checklist of what I need to communicate with that executor?
Okay. He has a trust, and it's actually, the term on a trust is called a successor trustee. An executor is over a will. Trustees are over trust. Same role, just different title. And his question is, do I have a checklist of things I need to tell them about? Yes, and most of the time your attorney can provide a general checklist. I have checklists that I send out when the trustee takes over that sometimes change because as times change, their duties might slightly change. But most of the duties are standard and there are documents that normally your attorney can give you to say, here's something to give. I usually give them out when people are choosing non-family members as trustees. And I'm saying, you know, if you're going to ask your friend to do this, they need to know what they're agreeing to do. And so that you give out some kind of a suggestion. Yes. Yes, yes, and they could be absolutely disastrous. Most of the changes that are bad, and this is asking about the new provisions. And by the way, ironically, Trump doesn't even agree with some of the provisions in the proposal. So I'm not sure how that happened, but there's two big changes that could absolutely turn us upside down. One of them is the loss of deductions. Itemized deductions, where they're saying they're going to try to keep the charitable deductions, but they may put a cap on how much you can have for charitable deductions. Other than that, they're going to eliminate almost everything but mortgage interest deductions, charitable deductions, and I think there was one other. The biggest impact is currently we pay state and federal tax, right? But when we pay our federal tax, we actually get to deduct the payment that we've made for the state tax, and it's a credit against the tax that we have to pay, so we aren't paying tax on the same money, theoretically. That's proposed to be eliminated. So the deductions that we can take against our state and local taxes are being proposed to be eliminated, which means then we would be paying higher state taxes and higher federal taxes. The other big one that's a real disaster is what's called the capital gains step up. And what the capital gains is when you have an asset, a house is a great example, and you bought it at this amount, and now 40 years later, you're gonna sell it. The difference between what you bought it for and what you're gonna sell it is called capital gains. And we have to pay tax on that. It's considered a form of income. But fortunately, the tax rate is fairly low. Well, one of the benefits we've always had is that if I die before I sell it and I leave it to my spouse or to my kids, at my death, it gets reappraised at the fair market value and they get a step up in the basis. And so it starts all over again. And so if they sell it the next day, no tax because it's fair market value. Part of the Trump proposal is, and I'm not picking on, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not picking on Trump, but that's what it's called as a Trump proposal, is that it will get rid of that step up in basis. And that will affect everybody, not just the people who have $5.5 million. It'll be everybody, because if you inherit your parents' house that they bought in 1950 and you turn around and sell it, you'll be paying tax on the difference between what they paid for it in 1950 and what you sell it for today. It could be enormous amount of generation of tax. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yes. Thank you. Yep. 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 Good point. He's saying that you've got to also calculate into the value of your estate life insurance, and many who are younger can purchase this cheap term insurance and have, you know, millions of dollars of coverage that combined with other assets plus your 401ks or IRAs and all that, you could be thrown over that limit. And so that's absolutely true. You could be in that category and not even have anything on anything to spend, but it's all going to come to your estate in on paper. Yes. You're never too young to do this. That's absolutely true. And it doesn't matter whether you're single or married. It doesn't matter. You do it. I the saddest cases I've ever worked on are where 20-year-olds have been killed in accidents and they've done absolutely no planning. So absolutely true. It doesn't matter how old you are. You need to do, it's just your responsibility to take care of who you're leaving behind. Okay. I'm going to be available up here to answer more specific questions as long as you have questions and as long as I have voice. Thank you for being here. Again, I've got sign-up sheets up here. If you want to talk to me and you want to meet with me, sign up and I'll get in contact with you. Thank you.